John Finnegan is being interviewed by Renee Garrelick for a town oral history. The interview is taking place at his home at 100 Kies Road on May 3, 1989. Mr. Finnegan is 67 years old. Your family goes back quite a ways in Concord.
Yes, I think you could really trace them back to 1849 or 1850, when a couple of the old great-great-aunts came over, one by the name of Costello and the other by the name of Moynihan, and found their place here in Concord, and wrote back to the Finnegan family in County Mayo, and suggested that this would be a great place for us to immigrate to. And in the 1880s, I guess it took that long for them to respond to the invitation or whatever. Somewhere around 1879 or 1880, James and Catherine Finnegan, with their oldest child and only child at that time, Thomas, came over on the boat, got on the train, and headed west out of Boston, and passing through Concord, where the train stopped at the station that was in the east, in the western side of Lake Walden, got off there and decided to stay here in Concord. They ultimately went to work for the Chases, whose home was what is now Park Lane and the properties in Concord. Lived in the loft of the barn for 4 or 5 years and worked for Chase on his farm and so forth. My James and Catherine bought a piece of land immediately after, as soon as they get some money together, in 6 or 7 years, I guess, across the street from the easterly gate to Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, the house still there, and built a house in their home, which reputedly was the first Irish home to have an indoor bathroom in somewhere in the late 1880s. And they brought up their family there. There was Thomas that came with them, Bridget, a daughter who scalded herself to death as an 8-year-old youngster in the kitchen of a very tragic accident. Patrick, James, John, Martin. Martin operated the M.J. Finnegan clothing store at 8 Walden Street for years and years, and was the first fireman and driver of the first vehicle in the fire department at the time. James, William, who later became a Catholic priest and a Monsignor and was very close to me. Aunt Mary, school teacher, well-known in the Concord school system. She resigned in 1919 when her mother died, and the boys decided she would run the house and they'd take care of her. And Michael, my father, the youngest. Of them all, John was the entrepreneur, an auctioneer, founded an auctioneer business with the Sheehans. Later, Arthur McGinn Sr. was an apprentice of his. At one time, he owned all the land that is now the Concord Dump, all the land that is currently under debate is zoned for business adjacent to a line between the westerly side of Route 2 and the southwesterly side of the town forest, the town forest property. And also the corner of Walden Street and Route 2 on the south side that adjoins the residue of the property of Walden Pond, which he sold at some time to Judge Kies, and Judge Kies negotiated a sale on of that property to round out.
Is this John Lee Prescott Kyle?
This would be old Judge Petty Kyle, I believe. I believe he's Petty, yeah. Then, without getting into too much of the details, the ones that John came down with Parkinson's disease would have been a very successful entrepreneur. And Patrick ran away to the Boxer Rebellion, joined the Rainbow Division in World War I, built the docks and pressed plants and brushed in France, and came back, settled his family in Philadelphia, where there are still descendants of his stream of the family there. And Mary, I guess, would be 110 or 15 years old now. There were still people that remember Mousy Finnegan as she was known, because she did continue to substitute in the school system after 1919. As a matter of fact, she substituted in the early and middle 30s when I was going to grammar school on the case. I would have my eyes. She was very strict. Michael married in 1921 to Mary Beardy from Cambridge. Interesting story about that is that they wanted to buy a house, which they did right after they were married. It's the house, the second house down Lexington Road towards Lexington from the Antiquarian Society, now currently owned by the Antiquarian Society. But the owner wouldn't sell to the Catholic in those days, and my father's first cousin was very close to Judge Fenton, who at that time was about to be appointed as a chief land court justice. And Tommy Cummings, that was his name, was the clerk of the court. So he had the secretary buy the house from this gentleman, and then the next day passed title to my uncle, to my father. And they walked over the hill, because it would be a straight line from the house on Bedford Street over the hill down to Lexington Road to take possession of the property. I forget, it's probably just as well, by the man's name that owned the property. But when he saw my mother and father coming over the hill to take possession, he was chopping wood up back. And when he realized what had happened, he sunk his axe into the chopping block. He couldn't get it out. And I remember years later, we have a chicken coop out there, and my father would show me that chopping block with the metal axe edge here, and he said, you know, that's a perfect example of what prejudice really is, when you get so mad that you have to lose your axe, which of course back in those days, I'm talking about, you know, in the 29, 20, 30 period, an axe was the question day, an axe was an expensive item. So I was brought up there, and we then, by that time, my Uncle Martin had the store, and my Uncle John was a successful auctioneer, my father, and John bought property, and we ran a farm. My father also worked in the post office in Chauncey Street in Boston. We leave in the morning at 5:30 to train and get home around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and work weekends and so forth on the farm. Our farmland was on Walden Street. Everything from the police station driveway down to and including the courthouse land and stretching back quite a ways from the road. And all the land on the south, on the easterly side of Hawthorne Lane, which the town now owns, and so that the lines, Kenny lines, Kenny Sober, town for conservation purposes. And our shed was, we had a a barn at the Walden Street and the shed down there. Collectively, we had about 30 acres. With roadside stand, which was well known because a lot of Boston people used to come out to get their potatoes for the fall and their squash for the winter. And various spiders and various things that we sold at the stand as well as shipped the stuff into the Boston market. They used to come there. That stand was right there behind on Lexington Road, just beyond the Antiquarian Society, right in the front yard of the property I talked about earlier, that my father bought. And adjacent to the next farm stand, which belonged to the Flavins, old Doc Flavin, Jack Flavin, Dr. Flavin's father. Family had a little farm and a roadside stand. Well, I'm wondering a little bit about the background. Let's talk about...
Well, by the time you were engaged in politics as running for a selectman, the Irish had arrived. So you told me you were the first Catholic selectman from Concord Center.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of things happened. You know, I think you can draw a clear defining line in the political life of the town, and really, I suppose, in the life of many of the immigrants, whether they be Irish or Italian or Swedish or Polish or what they be. And that line, I think, would be drawn between the beginning and end of World War II. Prior to World War II, there were few of us that had the opportunity to go to college. My brother and I, and my sister later on, after the war, of course, both had that opportunity. And it was almost a foregone conclusion that we'd go to Boston College. And my senior and my uncle graduated from Bay State. And it was inexpensive. We paid $57.50 a quarter to go to D.C. And I was accepted at several schools. I happened to have done very well in the educational field, thanks to the Monsignor, who treated me quite a bit for 4 years in Latin in high school. And my aunt, a school teacher, who was very interesting, both my brother and me. And so we both graduated very highly in our classes, a year younger than I am, and we went to D.C. and later to MIT, and I finished at D.C. and then the University of Michigan. But the war drew a line. And I know in my life, I suppose if I had been to the war, I might have still been a little farm and country boy, as I like to say on occasions when it's appropriate to say, don't ask me about those things, I'm just a little country boy, I might still have been one of those. But when I came back from the war, I was gone 3 years, 3 months and 2 days. I was discharged on the 11th of November in 1945. And I always thought that was the real reason for holiday, not harness. But when I got home, I did take some interest in the town. I had a college education. The farm had been passively successful. The young people, my brother and myself, were pretty well gone. Martin had died. John had died. Aunt Mary wasn't well. The property was about to be sold, and it was a new era. And between 45 and 49, 1904, when I got married, I took interest in recreational things and so forth. I think my maiden speech at town meeting was in 1947, when being active in the Twilight Baseball League, and it was a good league, there was a major cut by the recreation for the simple things like the bases, the balls, the bats, and a couple of gloves for the returning veterans to continue to have to sleep. And it was very active, very active. There were 8 or 10 teams, and it was competed for championships on a high level and a very competitive team. And it was great to have something to do when you came home from work or your field or working in the field or whatever. And I took the floor of town meeting, and there were enough of us there, I guess, would be the first way to say it, plus old Eddie Laughlin, who had taken the, was a coach for the Boston, for the Harvard baseball team, and took it to Japan, and his son was the captain and pitcher for, and Richie Laughlin played, that was his nephew, and young Ricky today would be his grandson. Played ball for Eddie, and the people got up and damned if we didn't win the vote. And the moderator at that time, I guess, with some interest in maybe the logic that was involved or whatever. And his name was Herbert Wardwell. Now, Herbert Wardwell belonged to the Tuesday Night Club. He was the president of the insurance company downtown. He was extremely active and good for the town in all respects. And there had been much discussion with the changing times of the political environment, with the new developments being built and across the place that we've been, and the younger people coming here, that there should be a newer element brought into the political life of the town, on a friendly and not in a competitive, irritable, mean way. And I think part of that probably, in discussions behind the scenes, was one of the reasons that Peter Wardwell asked me to serve on the finance committee. And I accepted, and I served for 9 years. Two of the last two of which I was the chairman. I think in passing, since this is part of the evolution of the Irish people, the Catholic people, in Sydney, in the town. It was rather obvious when Harold Smith was the chairman of the finance committee and he was elected to the board of selectmen that I would be elected as the Tim, I say that very humbly, but it wasn't really obvious. So in an effort to block that, the presiding officer at the time of the election suggested that as a senior member and probably the best qualified, I should make the first nomination for the new chairman. And God bless Eleanor Penn, you probably heard her name, but this again relates to the saner mind, if that's a good word for the transition, orderly manner to other groups of people coming in to help govern themselves. But the exception to this, and requested that I change over to fear the honor that the chair had given me so that she should keep the place in the nomination, which she did. And it was a relatively close call. The 15 members in the finance committee, I think that was something like 9 or 6 or 5.
About what year?
That would be 1957, the year before I was elected 59. There still was a little bitterness out there and so forth. I think I did a good job as chairman of the finance committee. I think I was capable, for some particular reason, unknown to me, to project the, in layman's simple language, the difficult problems in understanding Schedule A, B, and C, the depths of Schedule C, that come into the town, and Schedule B is the estimates of the various charges of excise taxes and so forth, and the projections in simple layman's language and how the arithmetic is done so the average person could understand what that is. What the total assessed value was, what the total the money's needed was, and how that calculated was determined, as well as take a broader view of some of the articles, both presented by boards and committees, as well as those presented by the commission, in terms of I do pride myself in training. I learn from those people that I rub shoulders with in town government that return what is for the best interest of the town is a statement that cannot ever be broken. And if everything would be measured to that gas, what is best for the town. And I hopefully measured most of all of my decisions in vain. I decided to run for selectman in 1959. It was a joint decision, I guess, made personally by me and my then wife of 10 years, and we had six children, five or six, I mean, no, we had six, and so there had to be a judgment. And with the encouragement of a broad spectrum of the town that had the best interests of the town as they determined to be at heart. So this was not a candidate that was running opposed to something. It was a candidate that was running because he felt he had something to give and had spent the years in preparing himself from a financial point of view. And of course, from a whole family point of view, the integrity of our family had been well established over many, many years. So the election took place in 1959. I think there were five people that were running. And of course, in those days, there were only three precincts. And it was a rather bitter campaign. There were those that thought I was too young. There were those that thought that the town wasn't ready yet for an Irish Catholic, who was a name that is so clearly Irish Catholic, to assume the position on the board. There were many little internal battles. But I guess if you went back and looked at the list of the people that endorsed me, not really because they knew me that well, certainly had no social ties to me, but thought it was time for someone who might be qualified to, of our background, to take their place in the government of the town for an orderly progress of the social environments in the town. You know, names like the Buttricks, Lovejoy, Sandy Ellis, Bert Newbury. If you go down the list of those such names that were on my political ad, you'd find that it wasn't just the list of the Irish running against the Yankee and just because it's the thing to do. Eleanor Fenn, Hope Chase, as well as my own Irish farming, Irish Catholic, and Italian friends. East Quarter and the Hubbardville Irish people that we grew up with, that we had much in common with and found prior to the war, and played ball with, those kind of people too. It made a rather interesting conglomerate, and I guess when it was all said and done, I led the ticket in two of the three precincts, and John Damon just beat me out in precinct two, which was West Concord, and John and I clearly carried the election by a point where some of the candidates, including a local attorney and a partner of one of our current judges, and a dear friend of mine, I'd been happy to give him a few votes. Those totals were that way. But once we get on the board, and I do think there's a great transition and difference between the boards of selectmen now and then. I found a much difference, of course. The first year was really an educational period. But I served with some brilliant people. I served with Bob Sheehan, who was probably the most practical politician, down-to-earth guy that I'd ever met. He lacked the full formal education that most of us had, but his education came from practical application to the people. Bob Sheehan used to visit every Concordian that was sick in Emerson Hospital every Sunday. Every single Sunday after Mass, and he'd come around and see us. Then there were people like Hal Smith. Great understanding for this, and owned the Colonial Press up in Clinton. His wife Maud was extremely active in those necessary things in the hospital and so forth. And Harry Robbins, who today is the senior partner, just retired, a little partner, more an outstanding attorney. Debbie Wilkins, Supreme Court Justice now, one of the most brilliant minds that I've served with, John Damon, back to the original days of Concord, Damon Dale, and great interest in the town, well-educated and very practical. Pinche served with me for 1 year, and I can really pass judgment on him in the broad picture versus the ones I had for 5 or 6 years. Bob Roddy, the most interesting guy. W. Roddy was his father, one of the big contractors, I say big only the local way up in West Concord. Built a lot of things. Bob, extremely successful. His brother, everybody knew, we had the Elm Tree Farm, Elm something stable down on Old Virginia Road. Bob chose the business world. Bland Rex plant and managed Van American Inca, and he and Hal Smith and Gil Bell, who served on the finance committee with me, and made their way. They bought Manawar Island in the Caribbean. But he a great Concordian and great interest in the town, great interest in the young people. But the fun we used to have on the board, you can't have anymore. And I don't say it should exist anymore, but I'm sure that it was necessary to exist in those days. The open meeting laws which we have now are very important, I'm sure. But our board would meet after the regular meeting at the Colonial Inn, 10 o'clock at night. We'd meet at somebody's, one of the individual's houses. We'd discuss appointments. We'd discuss balance. Shouldn't West Concord have representation here in this particular problem? Are the Catholic people being represented? Are the, Otis, what they used to call them, the Swamp Yankees? And not in a derogatory way, but meaning the Scandinavian people and the Newcomb people versus the old staid money people. Are they being correctly represented? and we discuss this. And we have our battles, we bury the hatchets, we get on about it, and we be the best of friends. We'd all go to the ball together. I remember once all going in the tuxedos at the time of the major concern of underground protection from an atomic bomb. Everybody was talking about this. I remember we deciding as a board to go over and see Brad Morse in his office in Lowell at 7 o'clock at night before the policemen's and firemen's ball. We all went in our tuxedo to do that and then come back and go. We all went to the ball. We used to have some fun and certain things. It was kind of a foregone conclusion that the junior member of the board who had to get decked out in a tuxedo and so forth would be the one to represent the board at the Emblem Club, which was the women's organization of the Elks. This was rather a patriotic event, formal dinner, procession, flag, and call for a speech from the Board of Selectmen relating to the activities of the June 14th Flag Day with the Elks on. We did, and the activities of the Elks Club in this terrible way and so forth. And, of course, the new man on the board, we have... I remember the fun we used to have on the 19th of April. Those were fun days. All the years, with all the members, that we'd always go to the ball, we'd always... I lived two doors from the Armory, so we'd always come over after the Grand Mass to my house, go back, and there'd usually be some activities after 1 o'clock, which we probably, after we took our wives home, participated. And one of the ones was a long discussion that we had about the calling of geese. And Bob Roddy claimed that he probably could call more geese at any time than probably anybody else, and we had a long discussion. And Ted Nelson was then the town manager, and Ted got the car, and the selectmen went down to the old North Bridge. And we stood in the center of the bridge, and Roddy started calling geese. And there must have been 500 geese appeared from the Great Meadows, and they all around the Minuteman statue and the obelisk and so forth. And Roger was there and said, oh, I told you, well, somebody in the neighborhood heard the calling and all the excitement, and they called the cruisers. So here are the five members of the Board of Selectmen and the town manager and 400 geese at the old North Bridge when the cruiser comes dashing and down. And Nelson said, what are you doing here? We had a complaint about some noise. Oh, he said, that noise was up on West Street in West Concord. We could hear it from here, and I suggest that you boys go up there immediately and see what you can do about it. And it was all done in fun. But sometimes humor, fun, relationship, and understanding for five people that are on the board of the governing board of the town, all from different backgrounds, different social fields, somehow or other, sometimes that helps add to their ability to get along together when it comes to making a judgment for the common good. At least that's my thoughts on the matter. I'm sure that the economy and social environment and the changing population is such now and the laws, that those days cannot repeat themselves. But you know, most all of us were longtime Concordians in those days. We are not what is now considered a longtime Concordian if you're 12 or 15 years here. Damon's family was here, God knows how long. Roddy was here, Sheen was here back in the 1880s. And they had a feel for the town, a love for the town. To me, and I say this frankly, even to this day, wherever I go, I go with pride saying that I'm from Concord, and somebody would say, Concord what? And I would chastise them for what they forgot in their second grade, and then quote them the first verse of the Concord hymn. Now, you probably would wonder what happened to me in 1965, which was, I was reelected. The political problem of 59 solved itself from a religious point of view. I look back on the Catholic-type people that I appointed with the approval of the board on the various things, and a lot of the names have served very well. Eddie Colbert, John McQuilkin, Public Works Commissioner, Lou McNally, who followed me, was a planning board and followed me on the Board of Selectmen, Richie Laughlin, who followed us on the Board of Selectmen also, Gus Cronin on the planning board, George Lawton, who did an outstanding job in the housing for the elderly. My brother, who was with the housing for the elderly, did an outstanding. Eddie Murphy on the Recreation Commission, outstanding work for the kids. The chance to bring along these type, all of whom were veterans, all of whom had good educational background, all of whom moved to the town for the love of the town, for the area and for the educational value of it, and all who started with very little but were successful in their own right and contributed much. I'm very proud of what I see these people have done in the last 25 years, and they in turn afterwards. I don't think really the problem of having a Catholic appointed anymore is as serious as it was then. You see, I think you can. It's gone. It's served its purpose, and it doesn't have to be discussed anymore. But it did have to be discussed, and in 59 it was discussed at the polls. I think it's interesting that 3 years later I had no opposition. I was Damon and I were elected with no contest. I made a judgment and. Two terms are enough, and that's kind of an unwritten rule, and I'm sure it's correct.
And during your time, the National Park Service, you negotiated with them about Minuteman.
That was very interesting. That was one of the that's one of the things that developed the year I was chairman. One of the years I was chairman. The National Park issue, and rightly so, raised its head because of the federal government's interest in the Department of Interior expanding its parks to the historical and educational areas as well as to the environmental areas of mountains and open spaces and so forth. Concord and Lexington were approached, as was the city of Boston and Charlestown and so forth, in terms of the Minuteman National Park concept. Concord itself was having problems with the Minuteman Park under our jurisdiction. There were debates at the floor of town meeting concerning appropriations of money for toilets and for parking spaces and for expenditure of taxpayers' money, and those were trying times, of course, and people were rightly protective of their Schedule A and their tax bill, and the Finance Committee had its overall judgments to make, which did not include probably the necessary numbers of dollars to maintain the park in the way that the transient American people now, mobile society, sensing many more people coming, wanted it, needed it, and it should be done in the interest of public safety and health. So there was a opening for political discussion with the federal government, and there was a jealousy and rugged independency of the Concordians as it related to Daniel Chester Finch's statue and to the bridge and what it meant. It was pleasant, unpleasant, difficult, and easy, all at the same time, to negotiate with the National Park people. But once they understood that, to a degree, they could have their way, but there were some immovable places that we couldn't, we would not discuss. Once they realized that they had to lease the property under our jurisdiction, with us having a right to take it back if we cared to, in the lease that was I executed with the other members of my board in June of 1963, the park proceeded. It took the Buttrick property. Now, the Buttrick homestead itself had no real historical, political significance other than it was built, I guess, right after World War I. Its real claim to fame, I guess, would be that famous issue of the National Geographic, which showed it as owning and having probably the finest iris garden in the United States, if not in the world, with the various things. The plaque to Major Buttrick, of course, is there, and they maintain that. And the old Buttrick home across the street, that yellow house, that has more significance than the brick mansion itself, which they took, they maintained as their headquarters and so forth, and reasonably well have got along with the town. There are areas that many people have raised, areas of problems that many people have raised from time to time, concerning their methods of maintenance, their handling of people, and that kind of management, questions of management for what they already control. And that will always exist, no matter what governmental agency does. What if you're lucky if 52% of the people will agree they're doing the job.
Ironically, your high park advisory committee of citizens today dealing with some of the same issues.
Yes, I am. And after serving for 10 years as the chairman of the Bicentennial, which related, of course, to Minuteman Statue, the beginning of the Bicentennial years, in 1975, and having the opportunity to feel and see and know the concern of the nation, the concern of the Department of Interior, as well as the concern of the town for the statue and the bridge and what it stands for during those periods, I'm happy to have the opportunity to serve on that committee, because I think I've had great exposure to the big picture. Maybe even a more exposure to the big picture, tainted though it may be with Concordians' feelings, than some of the management people of the National Park might have now, who some of them may have been still been in high school during the years of Bicentennial, and God forbid, some of them may have been on the other side of the riverbank. But that's another story. I feel that the National Park has a place in the town. I feel that it has, the Minuteman and the bridge has a major place in the history of the country and in the need for the youth to understand where they came from
by seeing physically, if they can visit, visually, if they can see it on TV, what the bridge is. I don't feel or agree that the national park or the federal government has the right, or is there the need for them to think they have the right to superimpose utopia in terms of their thinking of design of the national park on the people that lived in the various towns that made up the Battle Road.
You mean the restoration of the Battle Road?
The restoration of the Battle Road. There are rights that were fought for at the bridge that we objected to. We as the participants of the revolution objected to and therefore fought at the bridge, and the bitter cold years through Valley Forge for against the British for their rights that still exist. And there is no need except for the common good for things like eminent domain, imposition of big government versus the local say of people governing themselves. There's no need, as I see it, for those things to take place. And I resist that. Whether my analysis is correct or not, I don't know, but I'm very happy to have the opportunity when I sit on that committee. And by the way, I'm not too pleased with the cooperative effort that is being made by big government towards little government in this matter. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to express myself. And, you know, Concord has a very unique political philosophy. It goes way back, and I guess maybe I might interject this into the thinking of response to this question that you posed. Concord has always been a town that runs its politics on the basis of knowing its candidates. Whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat or what you are doesn't make any difference. It's, are you able to serve the town? Is your thinking in line with the thinking of the majority? You know, I was chairman of the Democratic Town Committee, which was a no-no in those days when I was elected to the Board of Selectmen, besides being an Irish Catholic. And somehow or other I feel that kind of a philosophy hasn't changed. The citizens of this town, in my judgment, feel that the individual rights of the homeowners should be protected now is the same, to the same degree as they were fought for in on the 19th of April in 1775. I don't know whether that makes sense to you, but I feel that's what the town is saying. The intrinsic damage, and I'm in the real estate business, too, and that is my profession. And I can sit back and look at what I say is the secondary damage to the value of real estate just by the threat of their property being taken by big government or something to match a promise which we think may be exceeded in its need. I don't know whether I'm expressing myself correctly or not. but I feel that way, and I think the town feels that way, and I think it will be of interest. I cannot possibly visualize the need for a walkway, a right-of-way across the rear end of the property, the rear of the properties on the easterly side of Monument Street and Main Street, and Main Street in the center of town, and Lexington Road down to Miriam's Corner, for people to walk where the Minutemen walked and shot at the British behind the stone walls. History can say it was done there, but I'm sure no. I don't even think that the souls that are buried in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery would be adjacent to that path would think it's necessary, and Lord knows they long since lost their right to vote. But those are my thoughts on that.
In a related concept, you mentioned you were chairman of the Bicentennial, and that must have taken a tremendous amount of organization, and I'm sure you have some behind-the-scenes stories related to that event.
I think it was an experience that called for a lot of sacrifice, but it was an experience that you wouldn't give up for all the money in the world. At that time, see, we're talking about a period now from 1966 to 1975. That's 9 years. There was first an advisory committee appointed. Bert Newby was the chairman, of 4 or 5 people to decide what was the best format for management for the programs that were necessary for an appropriate commemoration of the events of 19th of April in 1775. Once that judgment was made, within a year, we reported back to the selectmen, I guess within a year or so, and a committee of 25 was appointed, and I was elected or appointed and elected both, I guess, chairman. I took it with a great deal of trepidation. First, because I was now educating, from a financial point of view, 6 youngsters, all in college, all in the process of private schools, or what have you. And a great deal of sacrifice for my wife, because there was untold aggravation, major difficulties with numbers in the parade, the permanent memorials, invitation to the President of the United States, and
Gerald
what have
Ford.
You. Gerald Ford. And what have you. Patience, yes. But along the way, a hard hand. Yeah. It was necessary. It was necessary to say to a doubting Thomas Bunch that 7,000 troops can pass a given point in a parade on the Bicentennial in 2.5 hours, and then prove the point that it was done, and it was done. It was necessary to say to say that. Now, we had good advice from intelligent people that knew something about parades other than the meandering parades that we usually have on the 19th, which are very appropriate for the occasion. It took considerable discussion to bring the two camps together relating to inviting the President or not inviting the President. And you know, if you go back, when Ulysses Grant was here in 1875, and there are many great stories about Ulysses Grant, including of course, he stayed at Senator Hoar's house. And if you read what he said concerning the quality of bourbon that was served, You'd further read that the Concord, I think it was the Herald in those days, had the story about the president falling out of bed in the whorehouse, considerably under the influence, which of course Judge Hoar and Senator Hoar took great exception to. And then in 1925, the Vice President of the United States, Dawes, was here in the snow. And I did get much satisfaction in seeing the two justices that, of the old school that were chairman then, and some poor little country Irish boy having the opportunity to be a chairman with Jerry Ford. I thought it was appropriate that he come. It was very, very helpful that he was here, particularly from a planning or security point of view, with what we had to cope with. I do remember, and will remember to my dying day, one interview that I had with the press on TV. I think it was Channel 5. And it was picked up in one of the local papers, too, when I said that Concord is a neat and clean town, that the president is our guest, as are all the military groups and the political objectives, that the town will entertain in whatever way it chooses, and that Sunday morning, which was the next day, the town will be neat and clean, and people will be able to go to church as if nothing happened. Now, I said that, and I felt reasonably secure, but I did have my tongue in my cheek. But I must say to this dying day, that to my dying day, that Paul Flynn, who then was town manager, who assumed the responsibility of the public works, performing what I said they would do, and every single member of the Public Works Department did clean the town to a point where you couldn't find a popcorn wrapper and so forth. There were two or three other things that would be of interest. And there's a letter that I have here someplace from the chairman of the Board of Selectmen of Littleton, who was to celebrate their anniversary of the incorporation of the town within months after the bicentennial, our program. And he was having a great bit of difficulty because of the hawkers and peddlers and balloon sellers, so forth, and his committee's interpretation that if they had a state license, the peddle that you couldn't control them on a public way, and he was very interested in wanting to know how he or I were able to control them, because we didn't have them. I didn't write him back, but I did meet him. And I told him it was very simple, you just break the law and you just throw the bastards out, and when it's all over, they haven't got any money to bring you to court anyway, so it's the end of the ball game. And those things had to take place. I think you could do it today, if it were the right thing to do. And you couldn't do it except in a town like Concord, though, because you'd have the support of the people. Not to break the law, but to, in the common good, to interpret it differently than the vast majority of them interpret it.
Do you remember your meeting with Gerald Ford?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Jerry Ford was a fine and perfect gentleman. He was a little bit of a haze, you know, because there were some funny things that happened in that. I think it might have been the Republican Town Committee informally or certainly some Republican-type people had suggested that we have a big banner that would be on drop sticks behind the reviewing stand that would say, as Gerry Ford and his group went by, "Thank you for coming to Concord, Mr. President." Now, the reviewing stand was in front of First Parish Church, and I'll tell you another story about Sir Peter Ramsbottom, who was the British consul in a moment, but I just visualized that as something that would fall down in front of the governor and everybody else, and it didn't seem to be appropriate to me. So when it got up to me, I said, no, that's not appropriate. I'm sure that the president will be thanked at the bridge. I will thank him in my remarks. Phil Souter, chairman of the Board of Selectmen, will thank him in his remarks. And Dana Greeley, as minister of the First Parish Church, will, I'm sure, thank him in his remarks. So the answer is no. Well, oh, kinds of consternation, including Will Alcola's Board of Selectmen, and all of them. So they called the Board of Selectmen, they put all kinds of pressure on Phil Souter, and Phil said, whatever Finnegan says, that's the way it's going to be. And they went behind him to two other members of an influential group, and they called Souter, and Souter said, call Finnegan, and I said no, and that was the end of it. We did some nice things. The president arrived by helicopter with two backup helicopters at the Penn School tennis courts, and they had some white stones welcoming him, and that was very appropriate, very appropriate. We presented him with a solid gold commemorative coin. I also have one presented to me by the committee. God knows where it came from, but it's my fault, and I appreciate it very much. And there was one, I guess, that went to the governor, though John Eaton, who was chairman of the coin subcommittee, was the one to make that presentation. The other rather humorous thing that happened was I didn't know exactly how to handle Sir Peter Ramsbottom, who was the British ambassador, not the consul, the British ambassador to the United States, who decided in his great wisdom to come and be with us on this day of his defeat. But I thought of Herbie Wilkins, and I knew Herbie was very loquacious, and his father was, of course, had been a Supreme Court judge for him, and they had been over to England. And so I said to Herbie, would you take over Sir Peter? And Herbie agreed. And he got hold of Henry Lachlan, who's got this beautiful estate, of course, up off Monument Street near the Carlisle Line. And Henry, of course, would know all those people, and Henry agreed to put the ambassador up overnight. So they picked up his Rolls Royce and took it up to Henry Lachlan's house, and Henry had a nice dinner party. Herbie was there. I was invited, but I didn't go. Herbie, I had other problems that night. Herbie was there. And early in the morning, with the parade of vehicles, the dignitaries, the Rolls Royce, with Sir Peter, his secretary in a morning suit, and his chauffeur, put the Rolls Royce into drive and drove it down the long gray stone driveway of
the house he was staying at to get down to Concord Center. And when we arrived after the events at the bridge at the First Parish Church, these cars were permitted to go in a circular drive in front of the church. And Sir Peter took one look at his Rolls Royce, and he was going to Lincoln, to Lexington, man, and said to his secretary, get it cleaned up. Right. So we all get up at the reviewing stand, and Sir Peter was there, General Whitney was there, the governor and his wife were there, Ellen and I were there, and the secretary showed up, and said to Sir Peter, I'm not able to get any water to wash the Rolls Royce, sir. And he turned to me and said, how can that be handled? I said, won't you speak to Dana? But Dana Greeley gets this problem. And Dana says, the sexton's at the door. Why don't you speak to him? With the parade about halfway gone by, I turned around and I saw this extraordinary sight. The chauffeur with his hat on, stripped down to his undershirt, and the secretary with a morning suit on and these big, high, white cuffs where he makes his notes for Sir Peter, rolled up, and the two of them washing the Rolls Royce to get it ready because of the dust from Henry Laughlin's driveway to get it ready to go to Washington.
Oh, wow.
And I thought it was kind of appropriate to look at that and say, well, I guess they still do it in England. You sure couldn't do it here. You know, sitting and talking like this and looking back at some of the interesting things that have happened brings to mind the way the town handled the assassination of John Kennedy. Because I think that really kind of puts together everything that I talk about politically. I was the chairman of the Board of Selectmen the year that John Kennedy was assassinated. And it fell on me to make certain judgments as to how the town, as every other city and town, 351 in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, had to think about too. And I remembered much about the history of the Kennedys and the background of the Fitzgeralds and when they were up in Acton and Concord. As a matter of fact, St. Bernard's Church was where Rose received some of the sacraments. So I made the judgment that the procedure for the town should be the same as we did for Lincoln. The town was called, had its black crape the same as Lincoln did. And I thought it'd be appropriate that the independent battery fire at the same position, in the same formation, at the same time that they fired for the services for Abraham Lincoln, which was done. One of the things I regret is that the pictures I do have, a magnificent color picture taken of the battery in that formation, and as it looks the same as the Lincoln firing, but the pictures of the dignitaries of the town reviewing this get lost in the annals of whatever. But then I thought it would be appropriate that we have a mass for Kennedy, who's Catholic, and the memorial services for Lincoln were held in Protestant churches, as they should have been. And the reception for this idea was outstanding because it showed to me that even though there was probably every reason to do it, that any of this
bitterness that existed in my lifetime, thinking back to where in school the Irish all sat in the back room, back rows alphabetically after all the other kids sat when I was going to grammar school.
Yeah.
And
right
in Concord, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Yeah, but only in the third or fourth grade, you know, that year. But it pointed out to me that much of it was gone, and there was a service, a mass, at noon, right before, I think, it might have been after, the firing of the battery at the bridge in front of the statue, attended by the full board of selectmen, all the elected town officials, all the representatives of the various governmental people in Concord, and a complete cross-section of the citizenry of the town. And I felt good about that. And I'm sure I would have felt just good about it if it had been at some other church, because of his denomination being with that church too. But I've noticed this complete change. Oh, there's pockets of difficulties, like there'll always be pockets of difficulties with people and so forth. But the broad change for the good,
in your lifetime,
I've noticed in my lifetime. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Okay.